I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. There are 71 Republican delegates from Pennsylvania attending their national convention in Cleveland, Ohio this week. Donald Trump won every single county save one in the Pennsylvania primary earlier this year. This has been an unusual election season with Trump, who has never held elective office and has made controversial statements that would disqualify most other candidates the winner, beating a crowded field of candidates to be the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. We want to check in with two Pennsylvania Republican delegates to find out what they're doing and what they've been thinking about, Seth Coffer and Calvin Tucker. Seth Coffer is a gastroenterologist, also a ward leader and vice chair of Philadelphia Young Republicans. And Seth, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty.
And also with us, as I said, Calvin Tucker. He is the chair of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council. And Calvin Tucker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, well, thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Let me begin with you, Seth, but Calvin, I want to have you weigh in on this as well. From your perspective, what would be a successful Republican convention in Cleveland this week? Seth?
Well, I think it's already off to a great start. We've had a chance to mingle with and meet the other members of the Pennsylvania delegation, as well as some of the delegates from other parts of around the nation. I think the main theme and important thing to stress is unity, and I see the party really coming together. I think the choice of Mike Pence as the vice presidential candidate is part of that, showing conservatives and maybe people that may have doubted Mr. Trump's judgment that he will put conservative people in his cabinet as justices of the Supreme Court, as the vice president. And I really see that no matter, you know, where, what part of the country they're from, what part of the state they're from, the delegates really are different kind of delegates this time, more grassroots people, not as many establishment people. Mr. Trump just took a wrecking ball to the establishment of the Republican Party, and now the real hardworking people are the ones that have made it to the convention, and it's kind of a different one from 4 years ago, and it's a great atmosphere, and I do see it slowly starting to come together. Even the people who decided not to come to the convention, some of the typical, you know, former presidential candidates up for election this year, the polls have shown they're not being hurt by Donald Trump at all. He's doing well in their states, especially Pennsylvania. Pat Toomey looks great for Senate. Donald Trump looks stronger than any prior Republican candidate for the past several cycles. So I think the unity is going to be the theme, and we're all going to come together to make sure we win in November.
And Calvin Tucker, to you, now, I know that both of you were at the last convention 4 years ago. How do you see a successful convention? And it should be said that Senator Toomey is not there, as are a number of Republicans in the House from Pennsylvania as well. How would you mark a good convention?
Well, I mean, the basic reason we're here is to nominate our presidential candidate, and then subsequently go out and elect Mr. Trump, the president of the United States. So, as Seth said, unity is our theme, and it will be successful if we come out of here unified, nominating our presumptive nominee, Donald Trump, and then heading towards November, to elect Mr. Trump president.
Can you have unity, Calvin Tucker, if you don't have some of the more well-known, even past Republican presidents who are out campaigning for your candidate?
Well, yes, we can have unity. We have no other option to lead this nation but someone who can build. And Donald Trump has proven that he has the ability to build. On economic progress. So at the end of the day, everyone's going to be behind the success that Donald Trump is going to bring to the process. A lot of people are going through, the decision-making process, but at the end of the day, they have no other option, and they will be behind our candidate.
And Seth Cawthorn, have you been a Donald Trump supporter the whole time?
I have been a fan of his. When we started with 17 candidates, I could have supported any of them potentially. The way the nomination played out, he got a record number of votes. The reason, even if we lose some of these never Trump people, which I think it's falling by the wayside, and there were challenges for credentials or being seated at, for delegates for voting. And all of that has fallen by the wayside. And a lot of people are just coalescing behind Mr. Trump now. But even the few people that we've lost, I see that it won't even matter because we brought new people into the system. I've registered new voters that have never voted in elections before just to vote for Donald Trump in the primary. I've even switched Democrat, union, workers in South Philadelphia, where I'm the ward leader, that are first-time Republican voters to vote for Donald Trump. So I just see him as a game-changing candidate. I have been a fan of his for a long time. I have to admit, I watched his reality show. I've been really impressed by the way he is a businessman, a negotiator, the art of the deal. That's what we need to bring, common sense leadership to Washington, D.C., not cronyism, not bureaucracy, not the same kind of establishment on both sides, honestly, the Democrats and Republicans. That's why even Bernie Sanders people are responding to Donald Trump's message. We are building the party, growing the party, and we're going to have, I think, a record turnout this year. And in the primary, he's had the record turnout, whereas the Democrats have had lower turnouts in the past, and all the energy and motivation is on our side. Just look at the new registrations in Pennsylvania alone.
Let me go back to you, Calvin Tucker. You're the chair of the Pennsylvania Black Republican Council. And doing a little homework for the show, I think there are less than 20 African Americans who are represented among the almost 2,500 delegates. Are you Republican because of Trump, because of economic policies of the Republican Party?
Yeah, I'm a Republican from day one. When I first registered, I registered as a Republican. My family were Republicans. So, you know, I'm a second generation Republican. And I have many Democrat friends, but I think the Republican Party exemplifies the kind of programs that in the African-American community and the underserved community we have to have. We got to have a lower tax base. We got to be able to decrease the wealth gap in our community. We have to eradicate, poverty. I mean, City of Philadelphia is the number one poverty, yeah. And deep poverty are the 10 largest cities. So those are the kind of things that I think good Republican policy will help our community grow and strive and become success as we need it to become.
Calvin Tucker, I saw a recent survey looking at Pennsylvania and I believe Ohio saying that Donald Trump had literally zero support among African Americans. How are you going to convince African Americans that Donald Trump is their candidate?
Well, let me say that. I mean, you know, surveys. So if they said 0%, does that mean that Calvin Tucker is not supportive of Donald Trump? Absolutely not. So I don't believe surveys like that. I think there is a significant amount of African-Americans, and some say as high as 8 to 15%, that will support Donald Trump. Because I have an activity every Saturday with about 20 or 30 guys, most of whom are Democrats and friends of mine. And in that group, there have been five or six folks that are Democrats and say, well, look, Donald Trump is a builder. He's built businesses. He's created jobs across this country. And that's what we need. So when we look at, you know, the simple fact that the only way we're going to get out of this poverty cycle, of the dependency cycle, is through consistent employment and economic opportunities and entrepreneurship. And we need someone who's created jobs, who understands business, that and that's the engine that drives the economy. That's where I believe Donald Trump will make the difference in not only the African-American community, but across the board.
Seth, let me go back to you, but let me also correct myself. I had originally written this, and we had a guest that said something different. So apparently Donald Trump won all Pennsylvania counties in the Pennsylvania primary, according to New York Times, AP, Politico, and other Wall Street or other news outlets as well. I had originally written that, and then Dave Davies talked about one that went to Kasich. So according to the New York Times, Trump won all the Pennsylvania counties in the primary earlier this year. Let me go to you, Sev, and I wonder how what you make of the party platform that wants to overturn the Supreme Court's marriage equality decision, wants to appoint judges who represent traditional family values. I'm quoting there. Supports conversion therapy to in a sense cure gay people of their homosexuality. Something that's been discredited by the American Psychological Association and other psychological and psychiatric groups. What do you make of this part of the platform?
I think the platform in general is the platform committee is two representatives from each state. And even though we had a lot of new delegates in the convention this time, a lot of the same type of people were on the platform committee. And a lot of things, there was a groundswell of support to kind of put social issues more on the back burner. And that really is the feeling that I have among the fellow delegates that I talk to, and my generation of delegates being more of a millennial, younger generation Republican, that those are not the issues that Donald Trump or our country needs to focus on right now. I think, no offense, but I hate answering questions about this because it's just the same thing with how Democrats and seemingly liberals look at us, like as a gay person, as a black person, issues in specific groups. That is the game plan and playbook of the Democrat Party. Splitting everyone into groups and saying why they're going to help this certain group over that group, and they have a policy in government that's going to fix everything that wronged this person in life and this group. So to me, our Republican platform and philosophy, the conservative philosophy, is we have plans and programs that are going to help all people that work hard, play by the rules, can get ahead in America. That's what equal opportunity is about. That's what Mr. Trump wants to bring to the country. The real focus of the country, I would say, is look at the days and what Donald Trump's convention is set up at. Today is Make America Safe Again. If we look at the world right now, the biggest threat to LGBT Americans is not all the things you just listed off of. It is radical Islam. You saw the terrorist attack in Orlando. And seemingly we're having terrorist attacks every other week and cop killings every other week. This is really scary of what happens when we have weak leadership in the White House. Without a strong America and a president who understands that when you say things as the president of the United States, it's very important to follow through with your word. And if you're making a deal, you have to know when to walk away from a deal. And I can just give you two examples of that.
Well, you know what? We're almost out of time, and we won't have time for that. But just a quick follow-up to you, Seth. In that Donald Trump has said multiple things, sometimes contradictory things, about specific policies, things that he would do. You talk about the fact that candidates have to stand up for what they say. Does that give you support and confidence in your candidate?
I don't know what specific issues you mean, but I think Mr. Trump is very clear. He speaks directly to the American people on maybe a more basic level and, you know, wants to talk directly to people who can understand what his policies are about and keeping it simple. I mean, the tagline is, you know, make America great again, because there's so many things where we've fallen off, made dumb deals, been taken advantage of by smarter leaders of other countries. And now we're in the back burner, not putting Americans first, not putting the American workers first, having free trade rather than fair trade for Americans. And look what's happened to our economy. So
and I haven't
really heard difference of.
I got to jump in here. We will probably continue this when you come back to Philadelphia. Seth Coffer, Calvin Tucker, thanks for joining us on Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Thank you very much, Marty.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. While this election season has been contentious and controversial, it's also been an important lesson about how we nominate presidential candidates. With Republicans in Cleveland this week and Democrats in Philly next week for their party's conventions, it seems like a good time to talk about what is this process all about and to look back at convention fights from years past. And we have two guests who have joined us. Joshua Zeitz is an American historian, author of several books on American political and social history, wrote a piece that caught our eye in Politico recently called The Craziest Conventions in U.S. History, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Josh Zeitz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for the invitation.
You're welcome. Also with us is Philip Klinkner, professor of government at Hamilton College, whose teaching and research focuses on American political parties and political history, wrote a book called The Losing Parties, and it's about the out-party national committees back in 1956 to 1993. And Philip Klinkner, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Philip.
Sure.
How would you say that this election season has been a civics lesson for all of us?
Well, I don't know if it's a civics lesson. It's certainly been a wild ride.
It sure has.
It looks like at one time they were thinking about this would be an open convention where there was no clear nominee coming in, but that hasn't happened. So we'll see if this convention does anything to sort of change that.
What's your takeaway, Josh?
It's been an unusual year, that's for sure.
Has.
I'd have to agree with
Indeed,
that.
Yes.
I mean, we've had tumult at conventions before, but I think that there's so much about this cycle that's defied historical patterns that it's anybody's guess what happens over the next 2 weeks.
Well, I was going to say, do you expect tumult in Cleveland, Josh?
It certainly has all the ingredients for it. I mean, I think, if you think about a chaotic example of a GOP convention, 1964 in San Francisco comes to mind. But I don't know that we're headed there this year. I mean, what made that convention so unruly was that you actually did have a pretty intense and heated floor fight between two warring factions of the Republican Party, the moderate to liberal faction that was based principally in the Northeast, and then the kind of rising conservative faction that was really a product of the South and Southwest. But so many establishment Republicans are simply not going to the Republican convention this week that it may very well be kind of anticlimactic.
Well, we queued up actually a clip from the 1964 convention, Josh, picking up on what you just said. And this is the Republican primary candidate, Nelson Rockefeller, and he is speaking out at the 64 convention. This is in San Francisco. Let's give it a listen.
It is essential that this convention repudiate here and now any doctrine doctrinaire militant minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or Bircher.
And Josh, what's so interesting about that, and Phil, go back to you, is just here we've got Democrats talking about the KKK, the John Birch Society.
Well, that was Republican governor. That's right. I mean, that was Republican governor Nelson Rockefeller.
Oh, Republican, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah, no, of course. And he represented the liberal wing of the party. And I think he was, concerned, to say the least, by the kind of rising influence of right-wing groups, particularly the John Birch Society, which was stridently anti-communist and also largely opposed to the Civil Rights Act that it passed that year on the backs of moderate Republican and even conservative Republican support. So I think that clip actually did relate directly to that kind of that rising animosity between these two wings. And it is fascinating that we're having a parallel discussion this year about the Republican nominee.
How do you see the Republican nominee, Phil?
Well, I think the contrast with 1964 is an interesting one. Social scientists like to talk about sort of exit voice and loyalty. If you're in an organization and it's not going your way, what do? Do you remain loyal? Do you voice your protests, or you just exit and leave? And back in 1964, moderate Republicans, liberal Republicans like Nelson Rockefeller decided to voice their dissent. Now what you're seeing is that the more moderate Republicans are, for the most part, exiting. They're just not even going to the Cleveland Convention. They don't want to show up. They don't want to be seen there. Or they're being loyal. They're basically muting whatever sort of differences or criticisms that they have with Donald Trump. I doubt if you're going to have anybody who's going to get up there at the convention, certainly not in a key spot, and effectively denounce Donald Trump, which is basically what Nelson Rockefeller was doing. It was denouncing the party's nominee.
I mean, that's a much more staid convention than, and we've got some other ones queued up as well, Philip. That's a much more staid convention expected in Cleveland and possibly in Philadelphia next week.
Well, I think the chance for excitement is what's going to be happening among the non-convention delegates,
right,
and out in the streets. Or potentially on the floor, if people are able to get access to the galleries, even on the floor with the delegates, are you going to have these protests? And there seems throughout this campaign to be this sort of little dance between the Trump people and Trump protesters, where people come in and protest, and then Trump sort of takes great relish and delight in having these people sort of tossed out and showing how tough and how strong he is and so on. So it'll be interesting to see if any of that happens. Certainly there's going to be a lot of protesters out on the street. streets in Cleveland.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is from the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, where there was not only fights and riots and some mayhem in the streets, also inside the convention itself.
This is John Chancellor on the floor. I'm looking down at Edwin Newman in the middle of a huge bunch of security people. How did it get started? Do you know?
They keep coming around all day checking our credentials. And it's time they stop. There is nothing in the rules of the Democratic Party that says they have a right to check us every 10 minutes. They have harassed us an entire day.
The Chicago police are now in the aisles here with billy clubs, clearing people out. They're not using them on people. They're carrying them. And they're dragging everybody right out of the aisle here. It's a terrific crush. About 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Six policemen came in here, some of them wearing the blue helmets of the Chicago Police Force, and they are dragging out of here the people who were involved in this. One delegate from New York who objected to having his credentials checked.
This surely is the first time that policemen have ever entered a convention, the floor of a convention.
In the United States.
Josh, have we ever seen anything like the 1968 convention, either before or after?
I think not. That was pretty unprecedented. I mean, it was a perfect recipe for disaster. That year, you saw a heated primary battle between Eugene McCarthy and Robert Kennedy, and at first Lyndon Johnson, who pulled out after the New Hampshire primary. And after Kennedy's assassination, Democrats convened in Chicago, and what you had was a situation whereby every single primary had been won by an anti-war and anti-Vietnam War candidate, either Kennedy or McCarthy. But it was very clear that the convention was going to nominate Vice President Hubert Humphrey, who was saddled with Johnson's support for the Vietnam War, or at least the administration's policy. But Humphrey had not participated in a single primary. He had not won a single delegate via the primary system, because in 1968, most delegates were still selected by state and county and local party officials. So you had an enormous kind of conclave of anti-war protesters and delegates who were coming up against an establishment convention. And, you know, delegates had been handpicked by party leaders who were going to hand the nomination to Humphrey. It created enormous discord, and Richard Daley, who was the mayor of Chicago,
right,
came to essentially embody everything that was wrong with the old boss system. And what you saw was him unleashing his forces in response to the protesters.
Yeah, and those videos, just revisiting them, are just shocking and bringing back many memories. Philip, I mean, in 1968, yes, you have the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Also Martin Luther King, the Vietnam War is going on. What a tumultuous year that was.
Yeah, I think the big difference between this year and 1968 is you just don't have a sort of organized mass protest movement like we saw around the Vietnam War. There will definitely be protesters in Cleveland, and I'm sure there will be protesters in Philadelphia. But there's really sort of no comparison with 1968, where you could put thousands and thousands of people on the streets of Chicago to set up that kind of situation. I just don't think you're going to have anything close to that. The other thing to remember in 1968 in Chicago is sort of the context of sort of Chicago politics, that Mayor Daley was accused of sort of going soft on the riots that spring in Chicago in 1968. So he was sort of looking for an opportunity to show that he was in control politically in Chicago, and he was in sort of no mood to mess around with any protesters.
Yeah.
He was going to show how tough he was. And that so there are a number of sort of national and both local factors that sort of contributed to the mayhem in Chicago in 68.
Josh, there are things we cannot say on the radio, but you wrote about Senator Abraham Ribicoff of Connecticut. He denounces the, quote, Gestapo tactics on the streets of Chicago. Mayor Daley is in the audience. Again, we can't say what he said, but I can't imagine anyone at a convention saying what Mayor Daley said.
Yeah, I should clarify, of course, that his mic was cut at the time, or at least
yes,
you couldn't pick it up on TV.
But so you can read his lips, right?
This is what people read, through his lips. That's right. I mean, it was he and his family later denied that was in fact what he was saying, but that's certainly how Ribicoff and others read it. It was a pretty
anti-Semitic
slur, right? I mean, it was the party had basically riven in two at that point, and it was this all played out on television as well. This was, it's important to remember that this had only been maybe the fourth convention, cycle in history where most of the country was able to tune in by television. And so this was something that, you know, it wasn't just something you read about or heard on the radio. It was a television drama that played itself out every night.
That's Joshua Zeitz. He's a historian, and we're talking about a piece he had in Politico recently, The Craziest Conventions in U.S. History. And Philip Klinkner, professor of government at Hamilton College, our guest in this portion of Radio Times, taking us to the end of the show. And to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Phil, talking about even the conventions of today in Cleveland this week and in Philadelphia next week, what is the purpose? Is it to present this unified either message or face of the party?
Yeah, back in 1968, as Josh pointed out, they actually decided who was going to be the nominee because delegates were not pledged coming in there. They were controlled by party bosses, and conceivably they could sort of switch their votes. But since the changes in party rules in the 1970s, the real job of the convention is, as people pointed out, is to be an infomercial for the parties. The nominees have been decided. Occasionally you'll get some, you know, minor fights about platforms and things like that. But it's essentially an opportunity for the parties to sort of put their best face forward to the country, to send out their message, to, in many cases, to sort of introduce their candidate to the public who hasn't really paid attention much to the campaign so far. So the idea of sort of conventions as kind of a breaking news story has really kind of faded. And now we have conventions as sort of entertainment and really just sort of sending out these messages and images to the party faithful.
And have smoke-free rooms replaced the smoke-filled rooms of past? Philip?
Yeah. Well, first of all, these are all non-smoking venues these days.
Exactly.
People smoke a lot less. But the main reason is there isn't any reason to get people together in a room to really decide much. You know, it used to be the vice presidential candidates were picked at the convention. In many cases, the presidential candidates were picked at convention. And, you know, or you get haggling about the platform, but really very little of that goes on now. The way the party rules are set up is that one candidate or another has a majority of the delegates. They come into the convention. They pretty much write the platform that they want. And if they don't get the platform they want, they don't really care about it because it doesn't really mean much to them. They can disavow it. And so they tend to have sort of theme nights, and they put on the speakers that they want. It's all carefully selected. There's very little business that's transacted there these days.
Josh, is it worth all this coverage then?
Oh, I think it probably is. It gives the parties an opportunity to make their case to the country. But I think that's absolutely right, that as Phil said, these have become television shows. And it is interesting to me that that Bernie Sanders supporters put so much stock into the platform development process. You know, to Phil's point, these platforms today are fairly uncontroversial. Most people probably don't know what's in them, and the candidates are free to disavow them. I mean, it's interesting that the two clips you played kind of followed directly on platform fights in 64 and 68. I think the clip in 64 followed on the platform fight over the civil rights plank in the Republican at the Republican convention. And I'm, you know, the Ribicoff speech was directly in response to the Chicago police actions, but that those actions themselves actually followed closely on a very heated vote on the Vietnam War plank. So it is interesting today that Sanders supporters are so invested in that process, because I think Phil is right that it is fairly inconsequential, both from an optics standpoint and from a substance standpoint.
And from what I read in Cleveland, that the platform has been written or was written largely by social conservatives, and it is, you know, very conservative, wants to roll back the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality. It sounds like you both are saying is that the platforms, the whoever the candidate is, they can disavow, sort of move on from the platform, and it doesn't really play a role. Is that true, Phil?
Yeah, you know, there have been some platform fights in the past, but people just don't pay attention to it. You know, in 1968, I think it did matter because you had a group of people within the party who really did want to sort of criticize their own incumbent president's policy on the major issue of the time, which was the Vietnam War. And there's just nothing that sort of comes close to that. You know, the only thing would be if you know, the Democrats were to sort of put together a platform that would somehow want to repeal Obamacare or something like that. I mean, that was kind of the equivalent of what the Democrats were attempting to do in 1968 with Johnson and a peace plank in the platform. The other thing is, especially on the Republican side, everyone knows that Donald Trump doesn't care about issues or messages or whatever. He has his own sort of message, which is, I'm Donald Trump and I win and we're going to win. And that's about the extent of it. And he will kind of wave at Republican Party orthodoxy as he sees the need to do that. But I think the platform probably matters even less this year than ever. And so he obviously didn't really sort of invest any time or effort in attempting to sort of influence the outcome of the platform. And so social conservatives who tend to dominate in the Republican Party primaries and convention really kind of had free rein to sort of write the platform that they felt like they wanted. But again, at the end of the day, it probably matters very little. There's maybe three people out there who can actually read these platforms.
and we might be the three people.
And all of them have made up their minds already. So, yeah.
You want to weigh in on that at all, Josh?
I think that's fundamentally correct. I think the more important stagecraft to keep one's eye on is really whether the Republican establishment, such as it is, or embodied by Paul Ryan, perhaps at this convention, is able to restrain the speakers in any way, shape, or form. Because you do want to avoid a spectacle. I mean, the Republicans in 92 had something of a spectacle when Pat Buchanan gave a fairly fiery a fiery speech that really kind of waved the flag announced a cultural war essentially and frightened a lot of suburban moderate voters away from the party. So, I think the question is whether the cooler heads can prevail in Cleveland and prevent something like that from happening. Certainly. It's hard to see how they could avoid controversy altogether, given the candidate.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Joshua Zeitz. He's a historian and, again, wrote a piece in Politico that caught our imagination, caught our eye. We were curious about the craziest conventions in U.S. history. We've been playing some clips from past conventions. And, again, Philip Klinkner is with us as well. He's a professor of government at Hamilton College. 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here. Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. A lot of things coming at me this morning. And talking with Joshua Zeitz and Philip Klinkner about conventions past and present. Let me play another clip from a convention. This is the Democrats in Miami, 1972. And this is a news report detailing the events at the convention. Let's give it a listen.
George McGovern came into the convention with a decided edge. He established his predominance in a series of challenges that he easily won. George Wallace, confined to a wheelchair from his brush with death on the campaign trail, made a dramatic appearance. In the end, the McGovern delegates were seated. The platform he favored was chosen, and the nomination was his.
Josh, you want to comment on the Democrats in Miami in 1972? Interesting, George Wallace was a Democratic candidate.
That's right. Wallace had been a Democratic governor of Alabama, but ran as an independent in 1968 and then ran as a Democrat, as a conservative kind of backlash candidate. In 1972, he was shot while on the campaign trail and had just racked up a string of victories in fairly important states, but he was paralyzed from the waist down, and that effectively ended his run that year. But the 72 convention is an interesting kind of counterpoint to 68. As a reaction to what happened in Chicago, Democrats rewrote their rules that year, and they made it a very democratic and open process. And the result was that you had a kind of convention that was dominated by liberals of various stripes who clashed yet again with kind of establishment, with representatives of the establishment. The entire Chicago delegation that was effectively representing the Daley machine was not seated at this convention because it didn't comply with rules, new rules that enforced diversity from a gender and race perspective. And so an entire unelected slate was seated. It created a ton of controversy and chaos at that convention. You had elected officials, Democratic Party elected officials, who simply didn't attend either because they boycotted it or because they were not delegates. And it became kind of a hyper-democratic mess. McGovern wasn't able to deliver his acceptance speech until very late at night because there was no control really over the proceedings, and they droned on and on and on. So I think a New York Times reporter described it as the most unusual of conventions, in as much as it was the antithesis of a staged event. And it didn't work out very well for them.
Let me go to you, Phil. And I remember after 2012, the Republican Party saying, looking at their defeat to President Obama, saying we have to do a better job reaching out to minorities, reaching out to women, to certain voting blocks, if I can put it that way, that did not vote for their candidate, Mitt Romney. Then you look at Donald Trump and his various statements over the last year or so. What kind of problem does the party have with their candidate?
They have a huge problem, and you can see it in the fact that he's not doing very well in the polls, even though you don't have an incumbent president running. Even though Hillary Clinton's a relatively weak candidate, he still seems to be behind in most of the polls. And you have the most prominent members of the Republican Party who are if they're endorsing barely, or they're just staying away from a convention. You actually have, you know, U.S. senators, Republican senators, who are sort of running away from questions about Donald Trump and whether they're endorsing. They've got a huge schism in the party between sort of establishment Republican types. Some people want to call them moderate, but it's really not even that. In fact, some of the people who have been most opposed to Trump have been the most conservative members of the party. They feel as though they're sort of saddled with Trump. At best, this is what they're feeling, and they any alternative to try to get rid of him would be even worse. But they're, you know, privately and in some cases sort of publicly dismayed about the fact that here's this person who is, sort of extremely intemperate in his rhetoric, somebody who routinely sort of insults at a personal level other members of the party, routinely sort of thumbs his nose at sort of Republican Party orthodoxy, who now has the nomination. And they're all sort of scratching their heads about what this means about the party now, what it means going forward. So there's a lot of consternation among the Republican Party right now.
Josh, you want to weigh in on that? Then we'll get some callers and we've got some comments as well.
No, I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, if anything, I think this is the chickens coming home to roost for party leaders who essentially ignored populist opposition to their tax policies, to their immigration, to some of their immigration policies, to their trade policies. And he's managed to capture a kind of right-wing populist wave, which is incredibly disturbing to many establishment Republicans. You've started by asking, though, about the candidate and his party's problem with minority voters, and I think that that's, you know, that's an issue which I don't see that party actually addressing right now. It's not just the candidate's intemperance; it's also the very policies that they endorse, which over a slow period of time have almost locked them out of the Latino vote, which is something George W. Bush was determined not to let happen. And it's remarkable that probably the smartest piece of advice he gave his party is the one that they've patently ignored.
The idea of being welcoming to a diverse group of people.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a demographic time bomb for them, much in the same way that that the immigration wave from the 1880s through the early 1920s blossomed into a kind of working class ethnic constituency that the Democratic Party welcomed under people like Al Smith and Franklin Roosevelt, that made them a core feature of the New Deal order. The Republicans, in theory, had a shot at making sure that didn't happen again with Latinos. I think George W. Bush got 40% of the Latino vote in one of his elections. But now I think that they've clearly shut themselves out, and they might be in a situation akin to that of the California Republican Party, which made a decision in the early 90s not to be embracing, in fact, quite the contrary. And they haven't won statewide elections, by and large, with one or two exceptions since.
Wow. Let me get some callers in. I'll read some comments as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get David from Flemington to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
In some ways, has this primary cycle become the strongest case for party officials becoming the sole selectors of their party's candidate for president? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for calling in. Phil, is this a reason to have party insiders and officials and delegates picking the candidate?
I think a lot of Republicans want to think that right now, but I think that ship has sailed. I mean, we've had the current process now for the last 40 years or more. I think there's just an expectation that parties need to reflect the opinions of rank-and-file voters. I don't think there's any sort of legitimacy or any desire to sort of, you know, create a sort of new system of party elites doing this. I don't think there's any sort of real mechanism by which you could sort of do this. If anything, we're, you know, it's moving the other direction on the Democratic side, where Democrats now want to talk about getting rid of superdelegates or even getting rid of caucuses as a way of sort of, you know, even more firmly rooting the nomination in sort of mass participatory democracy, where people sort of show up at the polls to vote. So even if there's any desire for that, I just don't see that happening. I think that ship sailed a long time ago.
Let me get Rick from Warminster to join our conversation. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. I think over the last 6 or 8 months, we've seen a number of entities voicing their opinions and trying to coalesce. We've had delegates. Now we're in the convention phase. On November, we're going to have about 40% of actual qualified voters go to the polls. But ultimately, the Electoral College, those men and women, pick the president. So I'm wondering what role they play, because I know in the last election, even Hillary Clinton said we need to take a look at that Electoral College and how that plays into the decision.
Rick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Josh, this comes up every 4 years. You want to weigh in on that? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I think parties tend to favor that which favors them. It's interesting that Hillary Clinton should say that, because I think that, you know, you're seeing an electoral map emerge, which is going to be very difficult given current considerations for Republicans to win. And there are some within the Republican Party who are talking about really almost abandoning that for the time being anyway, and focusing more on being a congressional party, which has its own perils because you don't get to make judicial nominations or executive branch nominations and the like. I think the most realistic electoral college reform I've seen is the one by which if enough states opt in, they'll begin awarding their, you know, delegates to they'll begin awarding their delegates to whomever wins the popular vote in that state. And I think a number of states have signed on to the initiative, but the trigger will be when a majority, you know, states representing a majority of the electoral college buy in. I don't see it happening. It seems very unlikely. And it's pretty infrequent that we have events like in 2000 when somebody wins the popular vote and somebody wins the electoral vote. But it certainly changes the way candidates campaign, and it changes where they campaign.
Phil, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think the best shot is this sort of interstate compact where enough states basically agree that they're going to award their electoral votes to the national popular vote winner. But there was some momentum in that direction, but it's kind of faded in recent years. You've also had the Republicans in a number of places, Pennsylvania among them, who have talked about awarding the electoral votes on a congressional district basis. As a way of sort of undermining the ability of Democrats who win states like Pennsylvania or elsewhere to get the winner-take-all bonus that comes from that. And you've seen Republicans in a variety of states doing that. On the other hand, Republicans in Nebraska have talked about moving away from the congressional delegate allegation. So Josh is right. You know, parties sort of like the things that help them, and they'll implement policies that do that, and even if there's no consistency on that from one place to another.
But Phil, what is the argument for a caucus? I mean, this is a unique group of voters who are willing to devote hours of time it to select their candidate.
You know, it comes down to sort of who is the party. Is the party just the average person who decides maybe on that day that they're a Democrat or they're a Republican, or they're neither of those things, but they still feel as though they should have a say in this? Other people would argue that the party and therefore the entity that should decide who the nominee is the party activists, the people who are sort of devoted to it, the people who are at the very least are willing to show up for a couple of hours to discuss sort of platform issues and things like that, and be invested in the process and the party itself. over time, we've moved away from the idea that the party is sort of made up of people who are sort of active and maybe have leadership roles into it, into this idea that the party really is, at minimum, the people who sort of identify as members of that party and are, at the very least, sort of willing to show up to the polls for, you know, a couple of minutes to pull a lever for one of the candidates. So we've, in that sense, it's become much more sort of democratized. Other people would argue that we have sort of lost the sort of, you know, core identity of the parties, that the parties can really be sort of whoever decides to show up that day.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One from Ben on our Facebook page. No other choice isn't a great motivator to unite. Also, primary enthusiasm votes do not correlate to the general election votes. A tweet from Nate about Trump needing to expand the base from 2012 and reach out to women and minorities, something we talked about. He also writes that Trump promised a more showbiz convention, only been able to deliver on D-list celebrities. Big talk, no delivery. And, of course, Donald Trump is a divisive candidate, if I can say that. Josh, let me go back to 1924. Obviously, we don't have any audio from this, but this is a really fascinating convention. There were, 103 ballots, as you write?
That's right. There's probably audio of it somewhere. It was the second. They began putting them on the radio in 1920, but it probably wasn't recorded. Yeah, the Democratic Party that year was badly divided. You know, it's a little too easy to kind of oversimplify this, but if I were to do that, you had one wing which was very urban, tended to be more ethnic, more Catholic, more Jewish, somewhat more progressive in the terms that we would understand today. And then you had a kind of rural and southern wing that also, you know, that was not very progressive and also had a strong anti-immigration and in some cases anti-Semitic, anti-Catholic type tint to it. And the Ku Klux Klan actually became kind of a lightning rod. It was at the height of its political power in 1924, and it somehow became a proxy, a plank in the platform over whether to denounce the Klan became a kind of proxy fight between the two wings. There was Al Smith, the Democratic governor of New York, who was a Catholic, and William McAdoo, a senator from California, who was actually not at all racist or an anti-Semite and wasn't a Klansman, but because he represented that more traditional southern and rural wing of the party, he ended up having to wear that kind of banner. And ultimately, the convention deadlocked, and they ended up having to nominate a dark horse who then went on to lose pretty decisively.
Losing to Calvin Coolidge.
That's correct. That's right.
So, Philip, what will you be looking for in the next 2 weeks?
Well, I think in the Republican side, it's all about Donald Trump, and it's going to be sort of what he says. Is he going to be in any way able to sort of moderate himself to try to be a little bit more temperate than he has in the past? But it's pretty clear all along that Donald Trump is about Donald Trump, and he's going to be the star of his own show. I guess that a secondary thing is, you know, he's brought in a lot of people who are not traditional sort of establishment politicians. But as the Republicans learned in 2012, even if you get an A-list celebrity up there, sometimes they can do some stuff that's pretty far off script.
I think I know who you're talking about,
yeah,
right?
You know, this is famously Clint Eastwood in The Empty Chair. You know, now we've got, you know, Scott Baio and, you know, the Trump children. And there's probably no guarantee that they're going to stay on script. There could be some sort of, you know, excitement or of interest there. I think the Democrats will probably have a pretty standard convention. You know, Hillary Clinton is a much more sort of popular figure within the party than Donald Trump is. So I think, you know, probably no surprises out of Philadelphia.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Philip Klinkner, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Professor of Government at Hamilton College. Josh Zeitz, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. He's a historian. And again, check out his piece on Politico called The Craziest Conventions in U.S. History. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. Madison Poulter helping us out this week as our intern on Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.